So, Marshall, I'll ask you to call the calendar one more time, but just to keep things flowing since we take these short recesses.
Would you like me to call a case as well? Oh.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. So the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratvold, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Diane B. Bratvold presiding. And this is case A19-1488, David Timp et al. Versus Deborah Gibbs et al.
Right, and good morning to council. This is the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and we are hearing, we have six cases before us for consideration today. This is the second of two oral matters on our calendar, and then we will proceed in to consider our non-oral matters as well as conference on these. So I see council for both sides are visible to me, and it looks like, let me know, are you hearing me well?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. I can hear you as well.
Excellent. And of course, you've got instructions already about what to do if by any chance we should lose contact with you. But we will proceed much as we always do. You understand the time limits for both sides. You've got a visible, I hope, on the clock right now. And let us know if that fails you in any way as well during the course of proceedings. And then I'll just remind you of some things that we normally do with our oral arguments, and I'm sure you're aware of. So when you begin your remarks, if you would please identify yourself for the record, as well as the client that you represent, and then proceed with your argument, keeping an eye on the clock. Of course, respondent, counsel for appellant has got the initial 15 minutes as well as 5 minutes for rebuttal. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin if you're ready.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Ryan Simafranca, representing the appellants, which I'll refer to the Gibbs, refer to the respondents as the Timps. I'd like to start off by saying that this is a unique case where it's an electronic transfer payment case, and it needs electronic transfer law to be applied in order to resolve the issues. Article 4A of the Uniform Commercial Code is applicable specifically to consumer wire transfers like the TIMPS, controls this case. It defines the payment date of the electronic transfer, which answers the question, when did the TIMPS pay the Gibbs by electronic transfer?
Can I just stop you before we get into an argument about how the UCC defines electronic transfer and just ask a basic question, and that is there precedent that suggests the UCC applies in Minnesota to a settlement agreement?
I did not find any precedent that answers that specific question. What I do have is specific, there's a specific provision in Article 4A that Article 4A applies to electronic funds transfer cases. That's the key. Not whether or not it is a Article 2 involving goods or a settlement agreement. What specifically the article.
Counsel, can I just interrupt
yes.
again?
Yes, go ahead.
4A apply between the bank and its customer? Here you've got two individuals and there are two banks involved.
Yes.
4A governs the relationship between electronic fund transfers between the bank and its customer. So how is that applicable here in helping us interpret the word pay?
It's applicable from the standpoint that it involves that Article 4A governs all parties to the electronic transfer. It breaks down the transfer, the electronic transfer into its components. And it determines the rights, liabilities, and the rights and liabilities of all parties subject to that. That would include the banks as well as the person making the transfer and the beneficiary receiving the payment order. Does that help and answer your question?
Well, it still seems to, I mean, I guess that's helpful. But it still seems to really regulate the banks. And we've got two individuals here who have just chosen to use a particular method by which payments should be made. So I don't see it. But anyway, why don't you continue on with your argument?
Sure. I think it's important to note that the TIMPs have complete control. They can pick who they want to use, who they want to use for the financial intermediary to do their electronic transfer. They can pick the speed, which Ms. Anderle picked was 3 days business, 3 business days for free. And that was her speed that she picked. She also picked when she would put the payment order in. She procrastinated into the last day of the month. She waited almost 30 days.
Counsel, there wasn't anything in the party settlement agreement that prevented that.
Absolutely not. They can wait to the last day, but when they wait to the last day, they should be held responsible for any issues that come along with that, which would include a late payment. Late payment on a time is of the essence contract, like the party's settlement agreement, and where cases like Grant v. Munch applies, where there is a 1 day late, and in this case, five payments that are late, that constitutes a material breach of the contract. And it also, and I wanted to get specifically into the payment date, because there is no other body of law in Minnesota that specifically breaks down what a electronic transfer is and what the payment date is. The payment date is the day that the order is received by the beneficiary bank, in this particular case, Minnesota Lakes Bank. That's the settlement date. Now the draft-
Yeah, your argument is premised on the UCC applying to this contract.
Correct, Your Honor. We believe that Minnesota Statute 336-4A-401 controls. And therefore, the payments that were made by Ms. Anderle came in and was settled on February 5th, March 6th, and April 4th. They were all due on the payment date as stated in Exhibit A of the payment schedule. They're all due on the first of the month. So therefore, February was 4 days late, March was 5 days late, and it involved an NSF rejection of her payment order. That's why it was 5 days late. April came in.
Frank, hopefully I'm pronouncing your name correctly. If not, please let me know. But if I could interrupt again. So the phrase payment date is what you're pointing out in the UCC. Now, the only place that phrase appears is as a heading in Exhibit A. And as I read the settlement agreement, it contains a lot of boilerplate provisions at the end, one of which is that headings are not to be used in terms of construing the meaning of the agreement. And in the agreement itself, it uses the word pay. It doesn't use the word payment date. So help us out there. So how are we to apply this definition given those provisions in the agreement?
I'm happy to. The payment date is the same thing as the due date. It's just the first of the month. It was written by Mr. Timp's lawyer. Therefore, we can use the first of the month without going into any specifics as far as the due date. But it's unquestionable that the payment is due on the first of the month, of the calendar month. So that means February 1st, March 1st, and April 1st for those 3 months in particular. Not even discussing the June and July payments, which were 108 days late and 78 day, 108 days late and 78 days late. But just February, March, and April, the definition of pay as by Black's Law Dictionary, even that says, what is it, the delivery or transfer, the cancellation, a transfer of money and the cancellation of a debt.
Mr. Samafranca, in each of these cases, didn't in fact the TIMPs initiate that electronic transfer payment on or before the first date of the month?
Yes, they initiated the payment one day prior to the due date. That is exactly right. But if the UCC does apply, which is the only law that specifically addresses electronic transfer payments and breaks it down into its parts, then the payment date is the settlement date. And therefore, those payments are all late. It also justifies a reading that when February, March, and April are late, it allows the TIMPS to file their confession, which is what the parties agreed that they could do. Just like the In Re Terrell case and the Grant v. Munch case, the parties agreed to a specific remedy, and that was the remedy that they agreed on. And therefore, the filing of the confession or entry of the confession did not repudiate the settlement agreement. It was just the enforcement of their right. And how that's relevant is from the standpoint that the district court stated that it justified the late payments for June and July, which was 108 days late and 78 days late. But in this case, all the payments were late: February, March, April, June, and July. So the first month of the 6 month payment schedule in Exhibit A was not followed. That's the material breach that we are saying happened. That is an important root portion of the contract. Now, opposing counsel will say, "Well, didn't they get the payment? And weren't they paid?" But they were paid. Please consider, they were paid after the material breach, which was the five late payments, after they got new counsel, after they started litigation, and only paid in order to avoid paying the confession amount, and which included attorney's fees. So therefore, they don't get a pass just because they paid after the fact. The settlement agreement specifically says they need to pay on a schedule. They don't get to pay whenever they want. That's the ThermoServe case that says the court in their holding stated that they find it hard to believe that this was a payment of it when they can pay any time when there was a due date. In this particular case, there are due dates. It's the first of the month, regardless of whether it's a header or it's in the body of the actual language within the settlement agreement. In paragraph C1 and C2, both of them say the payment date is due on the first calendar day of the month. And therefore, as going to the root of the problem with a former renter that had a history of late payments and bounced checks, which happened in this particular case again, that's the problem. It goes to the root of the issue, which is the parties bargained for timely payments, full payments by electronic transfer. They didn't get that.
Right. But there's nothing. The problem I'm having is there's nothing in the agreement says electronic transfer payments made and received by. I mean, it seems like you're asking for the court to read that language into the settlement agreement.
Well, that's a good
How
point.
Am I wrong?
You are wrong from the standpoint that the definition of pay means to pay by cancel and pay in cancellation of the debt. Nobody's paid when you initiate a payment. Nobody's paid when you just make the payment order, especially when the bank is closed, and especially when the party making the payment, like Ms. Anderty, doesn't even have enough money in her account to cover the payment order. We're setting bad precedent to say that the payment order is the date of payment when there is not even enough money to cover the payment.
Well, I don't know so much
March.
That as that didn't wasn't she limited in how much she could transfer electronically? Because in fact, in February, didn't she try to make up that difference? Instead of staging the transfer on two different days, she tried to send a cashier's check to make up the difference, right?
That's right. That was a violation also because of the fact that electronic transfer was the only payment allowed. And the parties sent a email back and said, "Hey, strict compliance with it. We agreed to it, and that's not the way it is, and that's not an acceptable means of payment." Now there is a argument to say that initiating the payment or just making the transfer, making the payment order when the bank is closed or when there's not enough money, and that is the actual payment date. But that doesn't it defies common sense. As far as March, she, Ms. Anderle, went back to the bank after she found out on the first of the month, the due date of March, and she added money to her account, and then the payment went out after that. But that still wasn't, her account was frozen on March 1st. So that the
can I interrupt and just ask you a quick question? So for payments where the money left her bank,
yes,
the first of the month, so she can't get it back then. Are you claiming that's a breach? Because, and is there anything in the record about how long your client's bank held onto it before they released it to your clients and actually put it in your client's account? Do you know when those payments landed in your client's bank? Because
yes,
often a bank can get money and it doesn't actually put it in the customer's account for some period of time. So is there anything in the record to help guide us on that question as we're trying to interpret the word pay?
Yes, there is something in the record. There is a specific settlement. There are documents in the confidential document file or filing that specifically talk about what happens. How it happens is, at first there's a debit posting date. That's the day or day after the bank is open, and there's on a business day that they can actually look into the bank account and see if there's money in there. If there's money in there, they'll post the debit. So it's frozen, but the accounts are not available to the client, to Ms. Anderle or the TIMPS. That transfer then happens, and according to the speed that the TIMPS make or choose. The TIMPS said 3 business days for free. That was every single pop money transaction, said 3 business days for free, and Ms. Anderle was aware of the speed and chose that speed. And from there, then the transfer happens and it goes through the Federal Reserve Bank, and then it is received on the settlement date by Minnesota Bank, which is the Gibbs financial or beneficiary financial intermediary. That's their bank. In the record, it also states from their side that they received it on February 5th, March 6th, and April 4th. On that day,
Mr. Salafranca, I'm just going to call your attention to the fact that the clock has run out for your 15 minutes, and it's just fine. You were answering a question, I don't mean to stop your flow, but I sense that you were moving on to a new topic. So, and keep in mind too, you have 5 minutes set aside for rebuttal. So if you'd like to continue on that topic, you can do that.
Okay, just to finish up that question, Your Honor.
Briefly.
All I'm saying is to finish that question is that after the payment with respect to on February 5th, March 6th, and April 4th, which are the settlement dates, that's the date that Ms. Anderle can no longer call that money back and reverse it. So it's the date, and that's the payment date, according to the Article 4A of the UCC.
Thank
I'll
you.
Reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, and with that, we're ready to proceed with counsel for respondent, so you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brandon Schwartz, and I represent David Timp and Sherry Anderle. The parties have referred to them collectively as the TIMPS, although they're no longer married. It's been my honor to represent them in the lower court, not the initial litigation between the parties, but in their lower court case in this appeal. There's several facts here which were undisputed. It was undisputed that the most important part of this settlement agreement, as testified to by Mrs. Gibbs herself, was the $75,000. It was undisputed that the Gibbs received all $75,000 from the TIMPS. It was undisputed that, with the exception of 2 payments after the Gibbs filed the confession of judgment, all payments were initiated on or prior to the first of each month. There was 1 payment in February in which, as the court has already noted, there was the $1,000 limit on Ms. Anderle's account, and so she paid by a cashier's check. The district court found that that was material, that that was in violation of the settlement agreement, but the parties had agreed that there needed to be three states of default as defined in the agreement before the confession judgment could be filed. Thus, the Timps paid exactly what the Gibbs wanted. They got all $75,000. And barren from the record and absolutely fatal to the Gibbs' breach of contract claim is they have suffered no damages. I asked them each during their respective depositions, what damage did you allegedly suffer by your receipt of the payment a couple of days later? The parties certainly have a dispute over initiate versus receive and what constitutes payment. I'll address that in just a minute. There is no doubt, however, that the Gibbs suffered no damages whatsoever. They could not identify.
Counsel, when the agreement spells out that time is of the essence, don't we sort of presume some amount of damage by the failure to meet that term?
I think what you look, it's a two-part answer, Your Honor. I think what you look at first is when you say time is of the essence, first we need to look and see what the due date means. Here, the Gibbs have interpreted this contract that due date means that the money has to have been received in their account to be due. They acknowledge during their depositions, I went through piece by piece with them, each provision of the settlement agreement. It does not say received. So initiate by the Gibbs or by the Timps prior to the first of the month is compliance. And the Mr. Simafranca's position that it has to be received. Let's take this just in a normal check situation. If I tender a check to the court for payment of a debt, but the court decides to not cash it until 4, 5, 6 days, maybe a month, 2 months later. Well, under Mr. Simafranca's definition, I have not paid, I have not met my obligation until you cash the check. That's, I think, an absurd interpretation of the law.
Well, did the Gibbs have an opportunity to accept and receive those electronic transfers on or before the first of the month?
They would have,
I don't know that your example is exactly persuasive on that point.
They had to, they would be able to receive it once it was initiated by my clients. And in my example of the check, initiating the electronic payment is just like if I hand the check over to you. After we initiate the electronic wire on our side, it's out of our control. It's on the bank side then to go through the electronic transfer piece. And to the point of the questions on the UCC, first of all, this was raised for the first time on appeal. It was actually raised for the first time in the reply brief. And if you read the original brief versus the reply brief, they read like two different briefs altogether. The Gibbs point to, they say, well, no, it was actually raised on three separate occasions before the district court. But if the court looks at that, document number 6, which is their memorandum in opposition to our motion for summary judgment, all it did was cite the First Security Bank case. The same thing is true for document number 63, their reply. Again, all it did was cite the First Security Bank case, which is a 10th Circuit case. Same is true for the transcript during the oral argument, document number 88. All that was done was a citation of this First Security Bank. There was no discussion, no analysis whatsoever as it relates to the UCC 4A before the district court. And under this court's Minnesota Mutual Fire and Casualty case, the court can and should just refuse to address that argument. But if the court does address the UCC argument on its merits, I have been unable to, and the court's questions on this point are right on. I have not found a single case in which any court has found Article 4A of the UCC to apply to a situation like this. It has always been enforced with respects to a bank and a consumer. In fact, this court in the Rachuy, R-A-C-H-U-Y versus Anchor Bank case, it's an unpublished 2009 decision, said that it's the execution of wire transfers that are governed by Article 4A. Well, the execution is done by the bank. It's not done by the consumer. The consumer can only initiate it. Thereafter, it's the bank that executes it. So I don't believe that this situation, and is acknowledged by Mr. Simafranca, I have not been able to find a single case either in which a settlement agreement falls within the definition of Article 4A of the UCC. I don't think that that argument wins the day for them. I think we get back to, what did the contract say? It said, you're going to pay a certain amount each month, the payment in full of $75,000. It doesn't say that it had to be received. It says, hey, well, we did what we needed to do on our part to initiate payment to get it to the Gibbses. They received every single cent. Every single cent. They did not have any damages whatsoever. So that's the reason why their breach of contract case fails. And when we look on our declaratory judgment action, we ask the court to declare that we had performed or substantially performed under the settlement agreement. The district court correctly held that we had. We had initiated all of the payments with the exception of one cashier's check and two payments after the Gibbs had incorrectly filed their confession of judgment. I think if this court looks at its prior decisions in Coden versus Youngkrantz, as well as the TNT Properties LTD case, and I'll note that the TNT Properties case is almost identical to this case in which, the district court recognized that the parties had a, quote, long and somewhat acrimonious history, including a pattern of contractual compliance problems on the part of respondents, an atmosphere of distrust which may be contributed to the appellant's reaction. There, this court affirmed the district court that tender of a first payment less than 48 hours from when it was due was not a material breach. Same exact circumstance here. They got what they bargained for. They got all $75,000. And really what this case is about is they went in to the underlying action hoping to get $115,000, $110,000. They didn't get that. The parties settled their disputes, and that original litigation doesn't really matter. It was settled. Both parties acknowledged that they have defenses to each other's claims. Then they saw this opportunity to try and gain some more money by way of the confession of judgment, and they tried to jump on it. But they didn't suffer any damages, and my client substantially performed.
With Mr. respect- Schwartz, can I interrupt just for 1 minute? So yeah. Question I've got. The March 1 payment, was that payment late?
The March 1st payment, Your Honor, Ms. Anderle had originally tried to execute it, and she had inadvertently utilized her son's account. There wasn't enough money in there. She got notice of it. She again tried to reinitiate it on March 1st. So she did what she needed to do on her side on March 1st. I would note, Your Honor, also that March payment from Ms. Anderle was 1.2% of the total settlement agreement that the Gibbs don't dispute that they actually received. They received it on March 6th, I believe, was the day that they received it. So I believe that we did what we needed to do on our end to comply with the agreement. And if at worst, this panel were to find that somehow that was not, that would only be two events of default as defined by the contract. The February 1st tender of the cashier's check and this March 1st payment. There needs to be three events of default is defined by the settlement agreement in the confession of judgment before the Gibbs are contractually permitted to file the confession of judgment.
Mr. Schwartz, were you able to find any cases in support of your client's position, where the case did involve a time is of the essence clause?
As it relates to materiality and substantial performance?
Yes. Yes.
I didn't find one way or the other. What I believe that the court's decisions, when you look at the Congdon and the Coden and the TNT. I mean, I don't recall offhand that they specifically addressed whether there was time of the essence in there or not. It just was more to the substantial performance piece of the argument. Unless the panel has any more questions on that piece, I'd like to just quickly jump to the attorney's fees piece. The Gibbs have argued that they are entitled to a jury trial on the attorney's fees piece. By letter dated April 18, 2019, which is document number 68. Mr. Simafrankis sent a letter to the court stating, quote, because Rule 119.01 of the Minnesota General Rules of Practice require the defendant's brief a motion for attorney's fees in excess of $1,000 or more, defendants respectfully request permission to file a Rule 119 motion for attorney's fees. The parties in their discovery plan, which was document number 14, specifically agreed to waive a jury trial and submit the matter to the court. Both parties, as part of their motions for summary judgment, asked that they be awarded. We said summary judgment on our behalf and attorney's fees. They said summary judgment on their behalf and argued for attorney's fees. The court, in its order, awarded in our favor, and subsequently thereafter, we submitted the attorney's fees. Now, they complain that I'd taken this case on a flat fee agreement because of the substantial litigation that had occurred before. They incurred over $81,000 in litigating this dispute. We asked for $29,806. It's 37% of what Mr. Simafranca charged his client. They did not file an objection to our affidavit as it relates to attorney's fees. And if we look at the fee arrangement, that is only but one factor under the Lodestar method. We look at the time and labor required. We look at the nature and difficulty of the responsibility assumed. We looked at the amount involved and the results obtained. We look at the fees customarily charged for similar legal services. We look at the experience, reputation, ability of counsel. And then we look at the fee agreement. Here, the Gibbs served 163 different requests for admissions.
Counsel, I don't disagree that that's what the record reflects. My concern is with the district court's order. I mean, the district court cites to the Lodestar method, which, you know, would embrace all of the different factors you've identified, but there's no findings for us really to review on how the district court reached its decision, are there?
I believe, Your Honor, he does go through, he says findings of fact. He does say that the court has reviewed all of the submissions that we made, and that he finds that that documentation supports the claim for attorney's fees. He found that the $29,806 was reasonable. And I think that given the standard here, which is an abuse of discretion, in light of the fact that the Gibbs incurred $81,000 in litigating this case, $29,000 is certainly reasonable. It's certainly within, given the over litigation of this case by the Gibbs and the results of Gibbs is reasonable and fair and within the discretion of the district court. So with that, I know my time's running out. I appreciate the court's time and attention to this matter. I know it's different with the electronics, and I did bounce off the call for just a minute, but I was able to hear it on my phone. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz. I did notice that you were visually not present. I assume that you were able to hear what was going on. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. I can hear you. I can see you earlier. I thought you could see me now, but maybe.
Oh no! I can see you now. But I noticed that there was a point, I think, during the appellant's argument. Right?
Yep.
Isn't that right?
Yep.
But I didn't hear a complaint, so I assumed that you still had contact with us.
Yes, thank you, Judge.
Okay, thank you very much. So with that, I think we're ready to turn back to you, Mr. Simafranca, and there you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. The first point is that the district court got the trigger for filing the confession of judgment wrong. The plain and ordinary meaning, the words used in the settlement agreement, it says that in the event TIMP does not pay the settlement amount as prescribed by paragraph C1 above, TIMP shall confess judgment. The date of default only triggers later on in that same paragraph. It only triggers the amount of interest. That's the way that Mr. TIMP's lawyer wrote that. So therefore, even if the court does not apply the payment date and the applicability of the Article 4A of the UCC, we have February, which was submitted as far as a partial payment by cashier's check, which was not allowed, which wasn't allowed. The court found that they were not in accord with respect to the terms of the agreement for February. With respect to March, Council just admitted that the payment was late. Regardless of his reasons and whatever the excuses are, they waited until the end of the month. They procrastinated for almost a month, waited to the last day, and there was no alternative to correct. If they didn't procrastinate, that's their within their option to do, but they also follow the consequences of that also, which is if you turn a term paper in on the last day and there's some problem with it, you don't get to correct it. Now, in this particular case, we have procrastination on a time is of the essence contract. On March 1st, a letter in the record that says the account was suspended. It's not possible for the temps to have paid when their account is suspended on the letter, which dated March 1st. So at the best case scenario, when it was rerun on the following day after she put money in the account on that day, that would be March 2nd. That would be a late payment. Now,
for me to be clear, that was only Ms. Anderle's portion of the monthly payment?
Correct. Correct. And they decided among themselves to bifurcate the payment, whether it's 80% to Mr. Temp, 20% for Ms. Anderle. That was their decision. Now, later on, after they made the late payments and my client, we filed the confession, Mr. Temp took over and made all the payments. They could have done that from the very beginning, but they chose not to. So that was within their discretion. Now, all I know is that the payment for March was late. However you slice it or dice it, whether it's rejected for NSF and subsequently made, but they're talking to Mr. Schwartz said that this was like a check. Checks are not allowed as far as the payment, which the district court got right. Checks are a conditional payment, and the parties need to agree that a conditional payment is okay, is an okay manner or acceptable means of payment. In this particular, it wasn't. It's absolute payment. And the party, so therefore that initiating payment and like a check does not necessarily carry the day. It's really when the parties get paid, and that's receipt. So pay means receipt. You can't have payment without receipt. And Black's Law Dictionary, going back to the plain and ordinary meaning of it, pay means a discharge of a debt. Nothing was paid or nothing was discharged as far as that payment settlement amount for that monthly payment until they received the actual payment credit or when the banks received it, when Minnesota Lakes Bank received that amount, which was the settlement date. That's the plain and ordinary definition of pay. And that is what we're saying should have happened. With respect to damages, well, the parties agree with respect to that the damages was the filing of the confession. The event of Tim not paying pursuant to paragraph C1, which is very important, happened. Those events happened. There was a cashier's check made, not in accordance with February, with the settlement agreement. There was a late payment in March. That was not in accord with the settlement agreement, for which the district court got wrong because they didn't consider that check or that payment order bounced and was rejected and dishonored. And those two events, as far as the trigger, is what would carry the day. That's what the plain language of paragraph C2 states. It does not say that a date of default is required. Date of default is a trigger to interest payments.
So, Mr. Simafranca, your 5 minutes for rebuttal has just expired. Would you like to wrap up briefly?
Yes, I'll just wrap up briefly. This is an electronic payment case. It should use electronic laws that specifically relate to electronic transfer. Payment, you know, dealing with equity doctrine like substantial performance that's dealing with the drilling of a well and using the wrong measure of pipe or the diameter of the pipe doesn't apply to a late payment case. The case in our case, it's a late payment or it's a timely payment. There is no middle ground. Substantial performance does not apply like, say, a construction case when you have to leave the pipe in the ground and the poor contractor gets paid nothing. This is very different.
right. So counsel for appellant, I understand this matter is very well briefed and argued by you, and your relief is clearly stated in your brief,
Your Honor.
Which we appreciate. So with that, but to both counsel, thank you. The court appreciates our conversation with you. This matter is now submitted to this court for a decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So with that, we have completed our oral calendar for today, and we will be in recess to conference on those matters as well as to consider our non-oral cases. So our thanks to counsel, and we look forward to seeing you again soon. Hopefully it will be in person next time. We shall see.
Thank you.
Thank you.